the Cochrane Show. This is the Cochrane Show. It's not the whole show like you get every day. It's the shorter version in the podcast way. You must remember less time helps you stay. Yeah, this is the Cochrane Show. Yeah, this is the podcast show.
Rob O'Neill is, an infamous member of Navy SEAL Team 6. But before we get to all of that, you also co-founded something called Your Grateful Nation, which is a very cool idea, and I'd like you to plug that a little bit. What is Your Grateful Nation?
Your Grateful Nation is a foundation I started a couple of years ago when I left a special operations community just shy of 20 years, and it was kind of a scary moment because, you know, I still have a mortgage to pay, but I know I'm not going to get a pension. But I realized I had some skills employers want, the ability to solve problems, which is the biggest one, but then loyalty and stress management, team building, and other veterans. We've been fighting war so long, a lot of veterans want to not necessarily do 20 years either, or even if they do 20, still have to get a job afterwards. So Your Grateful Nation finds out where they want to live, what industry they want to be a part of, and then we make the introduction, and there's a 9-month mentorship, and then these they're getting into basically every industry out there, and every single employer that hires a special operator says it's usually the best employee they've ever had. So Your Grateful Nation does that individualized transition process for special operators.
And that allows guys that come home without the benefit of using their training to maybe put their training to work.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's so cool to watch not just the operator, but the family say that they now have a second career. Couldn't have done it without Your Grateful Nation. Then they also tend to have a tendency to realize what they're worth, because the military, the Army doesn't necessarily pay too much, the Navy doesn't pay too much. But once they see what they're worth, too, it really helps them out and eases some of the financial stress. And then again, you know, a second career that helps with the bills.
And since the infamous mission at Abbottabad, aside from Your Grateful Nation, and just Google Your Grateful Nation, you'll get the website. You can help in a million ways, and we hope you will, including you folks that do the hiring. But you've done a bunch of things since you left the special operators community. Oh, I shouldn't say that. You never really leave the special operators community. But you wrote a book. You're on speaking engagements all over the country. What are you up to?
Yeah, I wrote a book called The Operator that came out a few years ago, and still a lot of people, for some reason, it's difficult to find. You know, it's at robertjoneill.com. I got signed copies there. That's at Amazon, all that stuff. And it just tells the story of the life of the operator, which is, you know, me being a decent-shaped white guy that can't swim from Montana, who ends up a Navy SEAL, who ends up in Osama bin Laden's bedroom. You can do anything you want as long as you work hard and stay positive. You know, I get on TV once in a while, try to talk whatever sense I know about the craziness in the world as far as everything from combat to foreign policy and things like that. And then I do speaking engagements through a place called Leading Authorities, which is out of Washington, D.C., and just kind of take what we did in combat, why we were successful, and how a lot of those traits can are applicable to everything in life, personally and professionally, just general things like, you know, if you're good to your team will be good to you. If they want to work hard, if they feel like they're part of the solution, they'll work harder, stuff like that. So I travel quite a bit. I'm on a lot of different airlines. What's nice is I get to talk to a lot of Americans, like thousands a week.
Sure.
And so I don't need to believe a lot of the scientific polls with what's going on in the country. I talk to real people and one-on-one, but, you know, thousands of times, and you kind of feel how it's refreshing that not everything is as negative and horrible out there. Most people are actually pretty good. It's nice to hear that.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing I was going to ask you, too, about the morale in the military. What do you feel from, you know, staying in touch with guys or knowing what you know? Are we taking care of our guys?
We are doing a lot better, and it's not like anybody really wants to try to hurt the military, but like there's obvious problems. Everything from the strain of constant deployment to the problems with the healthcare and the VA and stuff like that. And there are great people trying to fix it, but like any other huge government bureaucracy, the problems are going to be slow, and it's going to be tough to tough to change it. But when President Obama was leaving, he didn't necessarily want to start a war in Syria, so that deteriorated. When President Trump came in, he took it over and gave the men and women a mission, which did help morale. In general, that they're doing well, but they're really busy. Again, especially the special operators, because they're in spots like everyone. It's kind of funny, like everyone knows where no one knows, but they're out there and they're doing it. And the fight's there. The ideology is going to be there, and we just 1% of the country's fighting this ideology, and it's not going to end tomorrow.
Yeah, and whether it's a Green Beret, Night Stalkers, Rangers, the Marine Recon, whatever, the Special Operators Community, and obviously the Navy SEALs, maybe the most famous of all. Nothing of significance gets done without you guys. You're all modest, and you talk about, you know, the real working folks in our service branches, but you guys are the cool guys.
Well, I think, you know, sometimes, well, we get portrayed that way because of a lot of movies, but you got to figure there's still infantrymen, Army, and Marines walking through minefields in Kandahar, very dangerous places, and they don't, a lot of them don't get the platform that we do. So, you know, I try to raise awareness of that, too. And you know, Marines are some of the best, obviously, on the planet, too, but they're out there doing the dirty work, sometimes with the lowest budget and the oldest weapons. But they're all out there doing it, and every part of it. No one person does anything. There's a team that, even on the Bin Laden raid, it was a group of women from an agency that found him. We had pilots flew us in, air crew that opened the door, and then the shooters got off, and everything from the breacher that blasted the door to the guy going with a sledgehammer up the stairs to the bullets that we fired at the terrorists. It's just, you know, someone made the bullets, someone made the guns. I was smart enough to carry one. That's about, and I turned the right corner. But there's, you know, they're all out there right now, one team, one fight, and it's, I'm proud of all of them.
Yeah, and if you heard us talking before on the Steve Cochran Show, bear with us, because I'm going to repeat a couple things here, ask Rob to as well. You told me on the air, off the air, I forget, SEAL Team 6 is involved in literally hundreds of missions, and many in post thought processes here would be deemed much more dangerous than even what you guys did that night. I guess we don't think about that. The missions we'll never hear about.
That's true. The night that we went out as a major command, the big one that we all were a part of, I think the Bin Laden mission was one of 13 missions that went on that night. And you've got, you know, Rangers doing other stuff, Marines and Green Berets doing other stuff. Ours was obviously the most high profile, but possibly not the most dangerous, because the danger for us was getting shot down on the way in. But once that didn't happen, we're in a place where no one expected us. You know, there were people outside live tweeting about why Pakistan was doing military exercise on a Sunday night, and they thought it was their own military training, right, when it's actually SEAL Team 6 invading the country, because we said we would if we found Bin Laden. But there were guys working all over Afghanistan that same night, taking down probably more dangerous targets because it was a war zone where Pakistan was not.
Yeah, and the thing is, decisions had to be made, and if you believe you know where Bin Laden is after 10 years, that's not a time for diplomacy, it's a time for action.
Absolutely.
And that's what you did. Now, you fly in that night. Let me back up a little bit, and obviously you won't tell me what you can't tell me. But how much in advance do you find out this is the mission?
We knew we were going after Bin Laden for about 3 weeks. 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks, something like that. They told us basically the first day we got to the first training site, just so we could be, you know, not that we wouldn't be laser focused, but just so we didn't have a lot of questions in our head what was expected of us and what could potentially happen.
So they have satellite photos of that compound in Abbottabad, but you don't really know what the inside looks like. Was that speculation? Because you don't know what you're walking into.
No, but you don't want to think you know what you're walking into, because as soon as you go in and someone told you there's going to be a left turn, the first turn is going to be a right turn, and it would throw off whatever rhythm you think you had. You want to get in there, let your tactics take it, and you overcome with your muscle memory and all the training you've done for so many years. And that's why they pick a certain age level of guys, because we've all been doing it for at least over a decade. And, you know, little things like, we don't want to hear how many men are on the target, how many women are on the target, and how many children. Just tell us how many people are on the target, and we'll figure it out when we get there. I don't want to go in assuming something's going to go one way, because it rarely does.
See, that's interesting, because you need to be trained to the highest level to be able to do what you do, but you're saying, I don't want to be told. I want my training to help me react. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, yeah, more respond than anything, because I'm going to go in assuming, okay, if someone said these are all women, and then all of a sudden you get there and they're all men.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I'll figure it out when I get there. And I've been, you know, I trained long enough to know what we call target identification. If something's a threat, I know how to neutralize the threat or eliminate the threat or subdue the threat, whatever needs to be done. And just training and training and training. And that started from day one. I mean, well before 9/11, we were doing this stuff.
So is it normal that you would have, on a mission like that you'd have a complete mock-up built of what you were dealing with? Isn't that what happened?
No, we did have a mock-up built, two of them at two different sites, but generally we have training areas called kill houses or shoot houses that are like, they look like hotels, but the walls inside are movable, just so you can set up as many scenarios as possible. It's getting used to reading off your your guy in front of you, and then how to deal with different angles, how to deal with different movement, and especially how to deal with effective communication without talking too much. And constantly changing our tactics, like when we, whatever we see overseas, the next group coming in when we leave to go home, we make sure we tell them what the enemy was doing, and then they're going to make the adjustments on their adjustments. And it's a constant chess match, you know, between better tactics, and we usually win.
So over the course of those 3 weeks, you train and rehearse and do the things you do. You leave on that night. How long a flight is it?
90 minutes. We flew 90 minutes from Jalalabad to the house.
And it's low, right? It's low and lights off, or mostly lights off?
Oh, it's all lights off. Yeah, it's and it's the pilot basically flying as close as he can to the ground. Just to, you know, the higher you fly, they're going to hear you further away, and he's just trying to get us there quickly. It leaves less response time for people potentially defending on the ground, and then it's up to the excellent pilots. And we were fortunate to have the four best pilots on the planet flying those two helicopters. So we flew in for 90 minutes, and then we got there.
Yeah, and by the way, you found out how important it was when one of those choppers had a malfunction and goes down. As you're landing, I mean, that's not something you expect.
No, not only not expect, I didn't even know it crashed until I got inside the house. And it didn't crash. The pilot crash landed it. He put it down knowing that if he didn't do it this way, he'll probably roll it and kill everybody inside. So in the blink of an eye, he decided how to save someone's life, and he put it in the front. There was a big yard in the front. He put it on the wall and in the dirt, and then they were inside. And then, you know, we did some maneuvers outside, and then we got inside. We saw our guys, and it's one of those moments in time where, you know, I'm not going to worry about how they got here. They're just here. Yeah, I'm not going to waste time by asking. We'll talk about it later if we live through the night.
So the chopper's down. You guys see it when you land. Am I making this up, or didn't you tell me one of the guys said, wow, they got a chopper just like ours?
Yeah, one of the snipers said something like, they're definitely ready for us. They have a training mock-up of our super-secret helicopter in the front yard. And the boss had to come over and say, no, you idiot, that's ours. We crashed. And he said, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. You're not expecting to see it, so you're kind of just adjusting what you see. And it's just spur of the moment, but, you know, we're human.
So how much time do you have in your head or based on the recon that had been done and the guesses that have been made? How much time do you have to complete this thing?
34 minutes. And there was so much stuff inside, it took us 47 because none of us really wanted to leave, but we knew it was time.
Sure. So you go in. Now, it's a total chance as to who's going to find him. You go in. There's different levels. Who do you encounter first in your route? Is it the sun?
The first two encounter were the two brothers, Abrar and then Al Kuwaiti, who one was a courier. They were encountered before I even got through the main wall. My guys from the helicopter that crashed already eliminated those two, and then we moved up the stairs, and that's where the CIA analyst told us we would find the son, Khalid bin Laden, on the stairs. I was still a few guys back, but I saw the point man engage him, and he went down, and then we went up the stairs, and the further you go up, guys need to go left and right to clear areas. You don't want to just leave a bunch of stuff behind you. So guys went left and right to clear the second floor, and then it was down to two of us. One man in front of me, and I was in the back going up a set of stairwell. A stairwell that had a curtain at the top of it, and he convinced me through some words, like, we got to get up through there. And I could close my eyes and picture it. It wasn't bravery by any means. It was more of a, okay, Bin Laden's going to be in there. He's wearing a suicide vest, and I'm just tired of thinking about it. Let's get it over with. And we went up those stairs. I was behind the one man, and he went through the curtain, jumped on some people that he assumed were wearing vests, and just because he went one way, I went the other, and then was Osama bin Laden standing there.
You have how long at that point, once you walk in, because I'm sure this has gone through your head a billion times, is he standing up when you see him?
Yeah, he's standing up. He's pushing his wife sort of toward me. Not very fast because it was dark, but he had his hands on her shoulder for sure. They were coming for me, maybe 2.5-3 feet away. And just, he's not surrendering. He's a threat. That's Bin Laden. That's his nose. I got to take him down as a suicide bomber. So I shot him in the head 3 times.
That's the training, right? You, if somebody hasn't clearly surrendered, hands up, and your judgment tells you they have, you have to end it.
Yeah, because most people, thank God, have not dealt with a suicide bomber.
Mm-hmm.
They can set that thing off very quickly, so you need to engage them in as close to the pons medulla in the back of the brain as you can to shut everything down at once and drop them. They just kind of fall on themselves if you hit them in the right place. And you know, anything worth shooting is worth shooting 3 times, I decided that night.
Well, and there's a specific science to it, as you just said. You take them out in a particular area with a headshot so that they can't still function enough to blow you up if they're wearing a vest. And by the way, you could have been the guy in front. dives on one of the wives or the another woman in the room, thinking full well that's the end of his life, but that's the mission. Yeah. And turns out she wasn't wearing anything.
That's why it's such a team thing, because he was very selfless, jumping on what he thought was a grenade for the mission success of the entire team, the entire country, the entire coalition. That's what's on his mind. It's not just a personal thing. He just did it because that's what he does, and he's a brave man. That's why I said it was bravery for him. I just went one way because he went the other.
Well, yeah, you're being modest, but I understand why. So Bin Laden's over. The room has to be, you know, chaos. I'm sure they're screaming and noise and other things. Is there any concern that others are going to be coming, or you're secure that your team behind you has your back?
Well, we knew we had their back, but the first responder for something like that is not going to be Al-Qaeda. The first responder would be the Pakistani police. And that's our concern, because we're not at war with Pakistan, and we do not want to get engaged with Pakistani forces.
Right.
And then the next would be the Pakistani military. So that's why we wanted to give ourselves 34 minutes, because we think we can get in, find out if he's there, and get out. And if he is there, we can get him in a body bag, get DNA, and split up into two birds, and then we can fly away. And then we've got a 90-minute race to get across the border in the darkness to see if we get to live through the night.
So when does mission instinct end? And just you, like everybody else, you're still a basic human. When does it take over the gravity of what you just accomplished?
About 5 seconds after I shot him, and I was kind of frozen in a standing near the foot of the bed, and a guy came up to me and he said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No. What are we supposed to do now?" And he laughed at me and said, "Now we find the computers. We do this every night, hundreds of times." And I said, "Oh, okay, you're right. I'm back. I just killed." I said, "Holy crap!" And he goes, "Yeah, you just killed Osama bin Laden. Your life just changed. Now let's get to work."
Yeah, so he knew you had something else to do. He recognized it, and you went on and grabbed as much as you could. So
yep, we went downstairs. There's a few offices. We grabbed what we could, and then we got out of there.
So was it a plan the whole time to get his body out so there wouldn't be a martyr situation?
Yeah, we wanted to get him out. And, you know, I've thought about this in the past. Like, because of their version of Islam, they're not going to have a shrine, because you can't worship false idols as a Wahhabist. That's like the whole thing with, you're not allowed to depict Muhammad or draw Muhammad, because that's a false idol. He's a prophet. Allah is God. So you don't worship. That's the whole thing with the depictions. So there would never be a shrine, but who knows? We took him out. We handed him over to some guys, and they took him to a ship in the Persian Gulf and then threw him overboard.
So you come back, and at some point the president, President Obama, is coming by to thank you and all that. And life, as you said, changes from that point. But before we leave this incredible chapter, a couple of listeners texted in questions this morning when I was talking about having you on the podcast. Are the bullets, I don't want to be too graphic here for people, but I think it's a legitimate question. Are the bullets collectible?
The ones that, no, the brass was cleaned up or whatever. When I didn't pick any of it up, and then the bullets, I'd imagine, were still in his body.
Yeah, embeds. In the 90 minutes that you were flying in, was it different than any other mission? Would you say it was more quiet or just normal? Whatever happens as you're getting ready.
Well, we were always quiet. We were quiet all the time. So it's it's same as always. The target was pretty much the same as we always do. We've seen it. You know, you got some bad guys outside. You have women and children inside, and they go to a corner. And they, you know, you can hear them whimpering and stuff like that. It's kind of sad because, you know, I'd be scared too if there's a bunch of armed men in my house.
Yeah.
It was basically standard. It was just a longer flight.
And as you're flying, what's going through your own head?
Counting, because, you know, worrying about anything else isn't going to matter, and I'm just trying to keep my mind off it. Like, worrying about a missile hitting us isn't going to happen. Or isn't going to change it.
Right.
So just count.
And faith in your brothers that you have the best team around you.
Oh, we did. Yeah, and there's no doubt about it.
Did you expect to survive?
80 or 90%, no. It's too far in. But on helicopter operations like that, you might you need to refuel on missions that long, and obviously we don't have posts in Pakistan to refuel, so we might run out of fuel and just be on the ground in Pakistan, which is not ideal. Shot down, blown up. I assumed it was one way.
And it was part of the assumption, the gravity again of the fact that it was bin Laden, because I think the most, for us civilians, for regular folks, we were all surprised that this guy didn't appear to be ready. I know he had weapons in the room, but you know, you mentioned he hid behind his wife or whoever the woman was. I would have thought if I'm on that mission that there's protection all around and this is going to be the ugliest fight I've ever been in, no?
That's what we always assumed because we were training so many different ways in case we were the lucky ones to get called to do the Bin Laden raid that we would jump into a hornet's nest or something like that. But once we talked to the people that found him, they were telling us who was around him, and he was basically trying to hide in plain sight. Like, they were really good about some of their security, but they didn't have a lot of people. They didn't make a big footprint, and he never left the compound. So they're just kind of doing that, and it was so many years that he just probably got complacent, never expected it. And I'm assuming he was going to move within the next year anyway, just keep moving to different places like that just to lose, so we would lose scent.
The dictators, they all seem to be the same, don't they? I mean, they're cowards who put other people out, and when their moment comes, they
hide. Yep, the bosses are. The bosses do that. They'll send other people to martyr themselves and like they claim to get credit for it as leaders. But yeah, I haven't seen a lot of big bosses fight to the death.
So you have family, and I know your family's getting bigger, and God bless you. It looks like a beautiful family that you have. But you and the other guys, I remember my father was part of the transport in World War II that was going to do a land invasion of Japan, and they all had to write two letters, one if they survived, one if they died. Do you guys go through that?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody did. I know on that mission we all wrote letters. I know I did. I wrote individual letters to everybody in my family, just, you know, explaining, because no one knew where we were going, so I was trying to explain the nobility of the mission. And I knew once they found out we died and how, that it's obviously a noble thing that we're doing it for the country and for the people who died on 9/11 and then the years after in the fight. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I'd done it before, but that's one I really thought they would read. And then as soon as I got back, I shredded all of them.
And that had to be a great shred.
It is. I didn't want to read them again.
No.
Part of me wishes I would have kept them just to, whatever, for whatever historic reason. But, you know, when you're in the moment, it doesn't seem historic. But the further away you get, it starts to.
You dream about it?
No, I don't. If I have nightmares, it's never about war. It's stupid stuff like dinosaurs or demons or something. Something's just stupid. It's weird.
What's your, outside of the bedroom, what's your lingering memory from that night?
Just the first time I looked at his house and then looked at the neighbor's house and the road that we'd seen on the maps, like, wow, we are actually right here on the X.
And it was go time. Was there a celebration of any kind once you got back on, or it was just let's get back to where we need to be?
Well, when we got back on the helicopters, it was just silence because we know that if we live 90 minutes, we can live for 50 more years. So we're flying out. And it was just quiet until we crossed the border of Afghanistan, and then, you know, our helicopter landed, the other helicopter landed, they pulled the body out, the admiral was there. It was just cool. We just did what I consider the greatest mission in modern history. We did it successful with no injuries, and none of our guys were killed, and now we're back, and hopefully we get a day off.
I know you've yeah, I see you've earned it. I know you've seen the video of reaction, but I can't tell you how great it was when, because we had heard that the president was going to make an announcement, and I was on the East Coast, so I don't know, it's 10:30, 11:30. I was in a sports bar of sorts in Florida, and everybody gathered in this little bar area outside of the restaurant, and the place just went bananas. And, of course, you saw everybody outside the White House and all that. It was a moment of unifying patriotism that we hadn't seen since 9/11 and the reaction after that. You know, we were all one for a few months, maybe a little longer before we started tearing at each other again.
Yeah.
But what you guys did is incredible.
It was incredible on a lot of levels. Just, I mean, even with President Obama saying he was never 100% convinced Bin Laden was there, but he was 100% convinced we can go in and find out and get back safely. That was his rationale. And it was even a bipartisan effort whether or not we should go or just bomb the place. And that, you know, like famously, Joe Biden didn't want us to go. Secretary Gates did, but he has, you know, but it came down to the commander in chief. But there was a bipartisan effort. We know we need to do something. Let's decide what to do. And, you know, it worked out well. Both sides worked together. It was almost crazy to see if both sides of the aisle worked together. Maybe we can get something done.
And that's the thing. If you want to be president, sign up, because apparently everybody does. The numbers keep getting bigger. But those type of decisions, nobody expects you to have to make those type of decisions. And, you know, we saw what happened with President Carter when he tried to run the Iran and the Iran hostage situation. It's a terrible decision to have to make, but thank God he made it.
Yeah, it's a great decision, too. And even that's what we learned from the mistake that President Carter made, because it just – so it wasn't, the branches of military weren't communicating as effectively as they could because they didn't work together. That's why they made the command that eventually took down Bin Laden.
You stay in touch with the guys?
With a lot of them. Some of them are still in. And the way that it works is it was described to me, I remember the day that I got there, that this place is like a freight train moving at 100 miles an hour. Stay on as long as you like, but once you jump off, it's gone. So you like anything else, you lose touch. But I talked to even one of the guys yesterday.
Yeah, there was a notion that you guys never talk, and then a couple other guys talked before you. Is that what changed it for you?
As far as
coming out and telling your story, yeah.
No, it was different for me because my plan before that mission was to stay in the Navy for 30 years, retire in Coronado, have a cigar every day on the beach, something like that, play golf horribly. But then when this happened, everyone on the mission knows what happened. And as soon as we got back, every Navy SEAL that knew anyone on the mission said, who got him? That's the first question they asked, and they would say, well, don't tell anybody, but. And then they would tell their bartender, well, don't tell anybody, but.
Right.
And so my name was out in the community in Virginia Beach, parts of D.C. and New York, and then out in Coronado. I got a call from Coronado that night from two of my former bosses congratulating me. And it was just a weird situation where it's like, I don't want my name to be out there, but you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube, and it just keeps getting further and further. And it took me a while to finally acknowledge it because, you know, the biggest concern is the security thing, but if people already know, me pretending they don't know is not going to protect me, so I might as well own it because hopefully I can help some families of 9/11 with the healing process, because there'll never be closure, but just healing with a name and a face of a real person that was there that saw Bin Laden die and killed him, actually.
Have you been to the museum in New York, the 9/11 museum?
Oh, a bunch of times. Yeah, I go there all the time. I love it there. It's
incredible.
It's never the same experience. Very, very humbling. You know, make some plans for about an hour or two of reflection afterwards. They actually have an area there called the Reflection Room where you can just sit down and think about everything. Because you relive 9/11, there's no doubt about
it. There's no question. Every second of every part of the day.
And there's tissues everywhere, so you can grab one. There's parts with that warn you of what you're about to see if you want to go around this corner, which I think everybody should see at least once a week to remind them of our enemy, but also remind them of our unity. The stuff with the people jumping out of the
building and recordings, voicemail, phone calls of family members saying goodbye.
Yeah.
I mean, it's heartbreaking, but it reminds you. And I guess if I'm you, I don't know. I hope you allow yourself to feel incredibly proud for what you guys accomplished.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely some pride involved, too. It would be an honor to be called to do it for obvious reasons. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot.
So when you think about where we are today in the world, who's our number one enemy?
Well, I mean, it all depends. For the individual, you know, the knife attacks is going to be the ISIS-inspired lone wolves, but we're going to have some major problems with China coming up pretty soon, too. A lot of the electronic stuff, a lot of the cyber warfare that people aren't paying too much attention to because it's not real yet, but, you know, it comes to a spot eventually where there's some sort of electric pulse that blasts out a lot of our infrastructure. That's going to be a big problem. I mean, it's a lot of the world is run by bad men.
And, you know, you think about what happens domestically here, the insanity of gun violence in this country. Virginia Beach is a very important town to you. So it's personal. Should American citizens have the right to have the kind of weaponry that you guys deal with?
They don't have the weapons we use. They have different ones. There's civilian versions of it. The big one, whenever you hear AR-15, people just they blow a gasket. I don't have a problem with making sure people are sane enough to own or buy a weapon. I don't know why people get so spun up on either side. Fine, make sure they deserve it. Or Second Amendment shall not be infringed. I don't think people need bazookas, stuff like that. But when it all comes down to, it's not the access to the gun. It's the bad intent. the intent's the problem. The people, the problem. What they're being taught. Like no one's taught to hate. No one's born hating. They're taught to hate. And you know, it's a very, okay. To take away the weapons now, there's still illegal weapons out there. There's millions of them there. You're not going to get them back from gun owners. It's just the response. It's too. It's a violent society, and I know there's more shootings here than a lot of places. But taking away the right to own a gun is not going to stop it.
Well, one, it's never going to happen, and two, it's the wrong answer.
It's the
wrong answer to the problem because the Second Amendment exists, and you're not going to change it. And frankly, we shouldn't. Having said that, eliminating the ability for nuts to get guns to do the things they do to the best of our ability,
we
got to do something. We got to do something. We got to take steps. You know, this guy in Virginia Beach had a silencer and extended mags. I don't know why those are needed by a civilian. And
I kind of agree with that too. As a suppressor, definitely. I mean, the only reason you need the suppressor is obviously the quiet gun, so you can't see the muzzle flash if someone else is shooting at you with night vision. If we're at that point, we're a lot deeper in than we thought we were. And I don't think you should be able to go to the gun shop and buy a belt-fed machine gun. That's a weapon of war, but an AR-15 that goes semi-automatic, you know, it's not. But again, the extended mags, all that would do is if in the unlikely event you're defending yourself and you have these ridiculous safeties on your mag release and you don't have enough rounds in your mag, it's just going to slow you down. The bad guy, usually the bad guy doesn't follow the rules, but you know, I wish nobody shot anybody ever again, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is we're not going to be able to fix the mental health problem in this country. That's the medium to long-term solution, and we have to fix it. But that's not going to happen soon. So what I'm looking for are things that can literally be done now, if we had political guts in this country in any way, to help move this forward. And I'm telling you, I support the Second Amendment, and the majority of Second Amendment supporters, and NRA members for that matter, all say the same thing. Let's do what's right and do it now, because, you know, 99% of NRA members, in my opinion, feel the way you do and feel the way I do. Maybe not 99%, but a good majority of them.
Yeah, I agree.
They don't want this either.
No, I agree. I don't think, and I mean, I don't think the NRA is the problem. Most NRA,
yeah, just as an example, I agree with you.
Members, yeah, they're mostly responsible. Not responsible. They're responsible with what they're not responsible for the killings. They're responsible with their weapons.
Responsible people.
Well, I mean, it's like if you took an AR-15 loader to put one in the chamber and even put it on fire. If you set it down on a counter, in 100 years, it's not going to shoot itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the person behind it. So, I mean, look at what they started doing with bread trucks. They take these big trucks running through crowds of people. Bad people are going to find knives to the point where they want to ban knives. They want to ban knives or register steak knives in the UK. I mean, okay.
We're having circular, stupid arguments about things when we should be saying, what is realistic that we could do to limit the chances that this will happen? Because we're not going to be able to stop it. There will still be crazy people who will do awful things, but let's limit the chances if we can.
Yeah, I mean, how about education? Stop teaching people that other people deserve to be killed because they don't believe what God thinks they think they should believe, or whatever nonsense it is.
Yeah, they're brown people or black people or white people or whatever.
I mean, there's bad apples out there, and it's just too bad.
You miss the time with the with SEAL Team?
No, not really. I don't miss it. I miss the skydive trips, I guess. Those are fun.
You miss jumping out of functioning helicopters?
Oh, yeah, that's a blast. That's a great way to relieve stress, believe it or not. Some of the camaraderie, you know, hanging out, but like the long days in the hot desert, I don't necessarily miss. And then just being away from family, I don't really miss. I think I did my part, and I had a good time doing it. I was very fortunate to be part of that team, so I'm good.
What about threats to your life now?
I don't know. I mean,
listen, I've seen you walk around. You don't walk around with protection. You're out there in public.
Oh, I do. I do.
No, but I haven't seen security folks with you. I've seen more security folks with regional politicians than there are with you.
Well, yeah, but see, I mean, would you rather see the security or not see the security?
Well, there's
that's
that.
What I'd rather.
If
you have too much security in plain sight, politicians like that security because they're like, oh, look, I'm important, check me out. I'd rather be able to have them be in the shadows than me just walk quickly.
But you don't spend your time worrying about it because what are you going to do?
Well, I mean, you protect yourself. I don't get into my security. Responsible gun ownership, sometimes dogs, cameras, and then good intel.
Listen, it's an honor to know you, and I hope everybody gets a chance to pick up your book if they haven't already. It's The Operator. The Operator is it's been out for a while, but it's out and available everywhere. Firing the Shots That Killed Osama Bin Laden in My Years as a SEAL Team Warrior, Robert O'Neill. You can order it at robertjoneill.com. Your Grateful Nation, you can help employ, and by the way, you'll be better for it, employ a highly trained special operator from any service branch. If you run a company, this is perfect. If you think you can mentor or help, it's great. If you just want to financially support it, it's great. And there's no better speaker that I'm aware of. You will have the room wrapped in about 30 seconds, and he'll answer all your questions, too, than Robert J. O'Neill. And I guess folks can book you through the website for that, can't they?
Yeah, they can find everything at robertjoneill.com, O-N-E-I-L-L. And there's speaking opportunities. It goes through leading authorities out of D.C. And then there's like everything from the apparel to late news stuff to, you know, all stuff, robertjoneill.com. You can find everything there. And, yes, I promise I can, if you get me for a speech, I will have you riveted.
I wish I had better words than this, but thank you for your service.
That's all I need. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Robert J. O'Neill. Rob, thanks for coming on. I hope we can keep doing this.
Absolutely. I always have a good time with you. We got to go golfing one of these days.
Yes, especially if you really do suck. I'd love to do that.
Great.
All right, Rob.
We'll fit together fun. Thanks, buddy.
Later. See you, buddy. Thanks.